Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Hello and welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Welcome to another installment of From the Drawing Board to the Engine Room Floor with the Apparatus Architects, Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. My name is Peter Matthews. I'm an editor here, and I would just like to welcome you to today's show full of apparatus news, information, and know-how. So, Tom and Mike, please take the show.
Hey, welcome, everyone. It's Tom Shand and Mike Wilbur. Very much appreciate everybody listening in, and here's the rundown of what we're going to talk about today. Topic number one is going to be some recent apparatus accidents, things that have happened here within the last 30 to 45 days, and Michael's going to talk about those, some of the impacts that they had on the operating members and how the apparatus fared. Second thing that's going to launch us into a topic that Brother Mike and I feel very strongly about, going to be talking about, are we really operating safe rigs? Just about every department in any fire truck that they've ever purchased, somewhere embedded in the contract documents or the specifications, it was either implied or specifically spelled out that the unit was going to meet the intent and all of the requirements of the NFPA 1901 standard on automotive fire apparatus. And that is an excellent document as a guideline for how we're going to specify and purchase our rigs. But once we go to place them in service, and some of those shots that you happen to see posted up on firehouse.com or appear in the magazine kind of leave you scratching your head every once in a while and pondering, are we really doing the right stuff with our equipment once we put it in service? So we're going to talk about that a little bit. Third topic up, we're going to talk about the availability of having tag-on orders to adjacent communities or major municipalities that are buying large quantities of apparatus, and what advantages and disadvantages they might have for your department if you were to pursue something like that. And we're going to probably finish up with talking about some pitfalls to avoid after you've signed the contract with your manufacturer for your new rig. Some of the things for, in terms of laying out the guidelines for expectations, terms of what's going to happen after that contract gets signed and the apparatus committee takes a big deep sigh and says, well, they think most of their work's done and now we're off and running and we're in the building process. So welcome again, everyone. We're going to start out with Mike talking about some recent apparatus incidents that occurred here throughout the country.
Hi, everybody, and welcome. We're going to start off with what's almost become now an epidemic of firefighters getting charged criminally in fire truck accidents from September 13th of 2006 to October 13th of 2006. We have had three firefighters, driver operators, indicted in three separate incidences in three separate states. In the first incident, a firefighter operator in Riverside County, California, employed by the California Department of Forestry, CDF, was involved in a collision on August 8th of 2005, and the district attorney in Riverside County formally filed charges on September 13th, which is a full 13 months after the event. The driver was charged with three charges. One was all misdemeanors, they were, but three charges. One was failure to shut off the auxiliary brake in the rain at the time of the incident. It was raining. The incident occurred on the I-10 in Riverside County, not too far from Cabazon, which unfortunately within the past month was the scene of five firefighters being killed in a wildfire. But in this incident, the apparatus operator was going too fast in the rain, launched the truck off the highway through some trees and down an embankment. His passenger was a 24-year-old firefighter who had been recently married, only married 6 months, and he was killed. Another charge that was filed is that the operator failed to have his passengers and all firefighters on board seated and belted. And the third charge was a misdemeanor charge of vehicular manslaughter. He faces upwards of a year in jail and substantial fines if he is convicted. In the second incident, in the state of Delaware, in January of 06, a 42-year-old firefighter operator driver was driving a 3,000-gallon pumper tanker Spartan, and in the words of press media, blew through a stop sign and killed an 84-year-old civilian driver. In that incident, the operator was charged again with a misdemeanor count of vehicular manslaughter, and also as part of the Delaware statute, was charged with operating the emergency vehicle recklessly in regards to not stopping at the stop sign as it's required under Delaware law when there's a lack of visibility at the intersection. And again, that operator first faces a year in jail and substantial fines as well. And finally, in the last incident, it occurred in August in Fairfield Township, Ohio, where a Latterquin responding to a car fire was involved in an intersection collision. The intersection was equipped with a preemption system, and it is alleged that the preemption system did not work. In any event, witnesses had the fire truck going through a red light. Accident investigation reconstructionist put the fire truck speed at 58 miles an hour as it went through the red light going to the car fire, which was 23 miles an hour over the posted speed limit. And again, he has been criminally charged with vehicular manslaughter and faces jail time and substantial fines. And just going back to the Delaware incident, that particular apparatus was responding to an automatic alarm. Just from an apparatus architect point of view, if you look at just the basic size of the rigs with the 3,000-gallon pumper tanker in Delaware and its ability or lack of ability to bring that vehicle to a stop with all that weight in due time, and also with the Quinn apparatus with the pump, the tank, and the ladder, and going at that speed, also not being able to stop on the dime either, you realize that not only do these incidents require looking at as far as the criminality, but also from the apparatus point of view and how much equipment and how much stuff are we putting on the apparatus, and how does it affect the apparatus's ability to stop? And although there have been tremendous improvements in braking systems and auxiliary brakes, the fact of the matter is, with all that weight and the design of the apparatus, it just takes a great deal of time and distance to stop.
That kind of takes us to, you know, things that, you know, short of getting involved in a major accident where the driver and other people on the crew now can find themselves both being civilly as well as criminally liable. It does bring about a couple of really important issues that we need to think about, and this applies not just to when you're decided to form an apparatus committee and have a new piece of apparatus join your fleet, but this is something that you need to take kind of a real close look at and almost do a report card on each individual piece of apparatus that you have existing in your department. First thing is with respect to what Mike alluded to is the weight of the vehicles. If we purchase a new apparatus, NFPA compliant, it's inherently understood. Let's talk about an engine for a moment. If the unit has less than 250 cubic feet of storage space for compartments, in order to meet and be compliant with the standard, when the vehicle is delivered, it has to have sufficient excess capacity with respect to what the axle, spring, tire, and suspension ratings are, both front axle and rear axle, to allow the department to put up to 2,000 pounds of equipment, the specified hose load, and allowing 200 pounds per person for each seat that's on the apparatus to have enough excess capacity of the unit to be able to do that. What Mike and I have found with the number of departments on existing units in the fleet, I'd have to say very candidly, of the last 6 to 8 departments that we have visited that have had more than 2 or 3 rigs sitting in their fleet, we haven't found one yet that there wasn't some vehicle of some description that was overweight sitting on the apparatus floor with nobody in it, and it really was, to a point, no fault of the fire department. It wasn't that the department put excess weight on there. It was, in some cases, the rig was never specified to have adequate front and rear axle capacity to begin with. Now, we'll take it without naming the guilty parties here through 2 practical examples. One department that we visited was very proud of their mid-1990s vintage pumper that they ran a light-duty extrication tool on. It had a 750-gallon water tank, and I think it was about 1,200 to 1,400 feet of 5-inch supply line. But if you went around the rig visually and looked at it, it didn't give you the appearance of it being overloaded. Upon further investigation, as we looked at what the axles and the different suspension and tires were actually rated for, we began to get a little suspect of what the unit actually was carrying. Became very suspect when we were doing an in-frame inspection of the rig, and became pretty apparent that the rear springs in particular were not only just flattened, but they were reversed. So we advised the local fire chief, take the rig out, get the thing weighed, and much to both not only Mike's and my chagrin, but certainly to the local fire chief, found out that the unit was about 2,100 pounds overloaded on the back axle, just the way it was sitting in the fire station. The way that issue ended up getting resolved is they ended up having to re-tank the unit and take 250 gallons of water off the unit. And again, it changed up the function and the utilization of the rig, but it was something that better to find out then than to get involved in an accident. But there was a situation where the newest unit in the fleet arguably was severely overweight and had been that way for probably the better part of 7 to 8 years until we just happened to point it out, and then as the investigation unfolded, found it out it was not just a little overweight but severely overweight. Now we'll go to another situation. We have a department that had virtually twin pumpers, one a 1988 model and one a early 90s model. Neither one was built at the time with a 4-door cab, and the department was interested in having not only cab enclosures put on these rigs, but changing out the bodies to a rescue style or a rescue engine style body. During the deliberative process, they asked the department if they had the units weighed. If they hadn't been weighed in a couple of years, went out, took these units, which were built by a very reputable manufacturer, had been taken excellent care of during the life cycle of the units, had less than 15,000 miles even on the oldest of the two units, and we get these units weighed, and lo and behold, we find out that they are within about 400 pounds of the front axle capacity and have less than 360 pounds available on the rear axle before they're going to be overloaded. So while it had a 4-person cab, unenclosed, with safety gates at the jump seat doors, if they go out the door with 4 brother or sister firefighters on this rig, it's going to be overloaded to the tune of 600 or 700 pounds. Now, we're not in the business to try to lay blame and say, well, who caused or who created this problem? You know, arguably you could say, well, you know, when the unit was delivered, it didn't have SCBAs in the cab, and we ended up putting 4 of those in there. We ended up putting a couple sets of irons and a rabbit tool up on top of the engine box. Yeah, we got a lazy Susan with 4 SCBAs, spare bottle strapped on air, and when you get all said and done, we probably added about 800 to 900 pounds that all went to the front axle on that rig. But here again is the front line unit in a good-sized department, that arguably the newest pumper that they operate with, and the unit is ostensibly overloaded as soon as it goes out the door with more than 2 people. Now, so there's one thing. We would certainly encourage every department that's out there, those folks that are listening, and whether your unit was delivered in 2004, 1994, or even more important, if it's 1984, we would encourage you to take these rigs out, take them out, put them on a scale so that you can run the front axle up, have the driver hop out, get the front axle weighed, then drive the entire unit on the scale, get the whole rig weighed, front and rear together, then have the driver hop back in, drive off the scale so just the rear axle's on, and then get a accurate rear axle weight. It's very important to do that rather than having the units weighed on police scales, which, while they tend to be rather accurate, are very dependent upon the unit being leveled exactly front to rear and side to side. So if you're in an area that has a stone quarry or a concrete facility, they very typically have these larger type of scales that we just mentioned. And first thing you want to do, you want to make sure your apparatus is safe and nobody's going to get jammed up to find out you were running down the road with an illegal piece of equipment. Get your rigs weighed. We're going to take a quick break right now. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the apparatus architect, Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan. Tom was talking about weight issues, and the weight of the apparatus really don't matter until it matters. Once you get in any kind of apparatus accident, particularly if it's a fatal or people have been seriously hurt, one of the first things that's going to occur is that the rig will be impounded, and then it'll be scaled and weighed. Many good departments who typically do all the pump testing and the aerial tests and the hose test and the SCBA test, we ask them about, well, have you ever weighed the apparatus? And the answer is an overwhelming no. You are responsible for that, and although the responsibility really doesn't hit home until something happens. Many states don't enforce weight laws on fire trucks, and some fire trucks are exempt, and yet the exemptions end when you have an accident and then you have to scale the rig, and that will be one of a multitude of charges that will then be leveled against the operator and the fire department, and you will be held again criminally and civilly liable.
All right, next thing we want to take a look at on our existing apparatus is access steps. Now, that can be largely dependent upon the era in which you bought the piece of equipment. A lot of the safety-related issues changed up dramatically back in 1991 when a lot of the issues that we had regarding the size and the location, the placement of steps, being that the first step from the ground to the lowest step on the apparatus couldn't exceed 24 inches, and then every succeeding step, if you look at like your back of your rig and try to access up the back of the hose bed, each succeeding step couldn't exceed 18 inches in a vertical plane going up to get up to the back of the rig. But one of the things we want to look at is saying, well, okay, the steps might be there, and this is where following the standard, as good as it is, but that's a minimum component in the system. How practical is it really to climb up these steps, particularly if they're all in a straight line up the back of the body, and you're trying to hit this with your bunker boots as you're climbing up the back if you're going to be racking hose? So it's one of the things, if you look at current day apparatus, there's a fair amount of the segment, particularly with rescue pumpers, where people have kind of abandoned these individual fold-down steps, which have to be a minimum of 64 square inches, or a fixed step that has to be the same dimension and be a non-slip surface and lit, in favor of a small access ladder, or call it a pool ladder, as some manufacturers refer to it, to get access up to the top to be able to rack hose back in the hose bed, as well as to maybe to rack hose and cross lays. Back in the day, when Mike and Tom first got in the fire service and we had open canopy cab rigs and you went to pull a cross-lay line, although Brother Mike, since he spent most of his career on a ladder company, he probably just stared at the hose, probably didn't help the engine guys rack it up, but be that as it may, when it came time to rack the hose, you simply stood up in the jump seat, or what people down in Maryland called the bucket, and you racked the hose back there. Well, now that you've got a four-door cab, You can't stand up in a cab and do that. You're now having to access the cross-lay area, generally from the side of the rig, which is dangerous at best, if not in some cases suicidal, and or you have to climb up the back of the rig. Well, you have to look at now that you're doing that, even if the job's down and you're down just trying to get the unit back in service, you're climbing up the back in your bunker gear. It can still be, even though the unit is completely NFPA compliant, it can be a little bit difficult to be able to do that. So take a close look at the location of the steps and the non-slip surfaces, and make sure, number one, not only do they meet the standard, but one of the things you've maybe seen a bunch of folks do at some of these conferences where they have apparatus on display, the next time you go to one of these, particularly if you're thinking about buying a rescue engine where it's going to be double high side body with a rectangular water tank, try flipping down those steps or looking at the way the steps are arranged on the back of that rig, and try climbing up into the hose bed in street clothes. I've done that many a times, just to looking at saying, well, here's the step, where's your next step going to be, where's your hand or your arm naturally going to grab onto something to make sure that there's a handrail there, and have an appreciation that doing it in street clothes is a lot different than doing it when you've got bunker gear on, particularly under dimly light conditions. So pay some attention to that, because the continues to be one of the first or the second highest incident of firefighter injuries on or about the fire ground are slips, falls, and strains. And a lot of times they happen just operating upon the apparatus in the heat of the moment when we're trying to do things and maybe don't have complete control of all of our senses, the adrenaline's pumping, and we try to do something, think we hit the step, but we kind of slipped off, and the next thing we know, we're down on the ground with our SCBA in our back, kind of writhing in pain because we've twisted our ankle up. Those kinds of things, we've probably all seen them happen, particularly in training incidents, but when they happen on the fire ground, it's even more dangerous because it's taken one person out of the loop of the evolution and made an already dangerous job even a little more dangerous. Final thing with respect to talking about, are we really operating safe apparatus, is looking at the position, if you have a pumper, of a top-mounted deck gun or multiversal stang gun, wagon pipe, whatever your local jurisdiction happens to call it. Again, back in the day when we had open canopy cab rigs, the roof of the cab was very common to be the high point of the rig, but the deck gun was always positioned to be higher than that, and what wasn't a problem of climbing, getting access up into the top of the pump enclosure and be able to spin that gun in 360 degrees and be able to operate it. Well, what have we done here in the last, say, 8 to 10 years that have changed that up? With the advent of four-door cabs that were required back, again, in the 91 standard, four-door cabs were great, but the next thing we did is we put raised roof cabs on rigs. In some cases, with some manufacturers, you can get up to a 22-inch high raised roof with Vista windows all the way around. Now, unless the Pope or some other dignitary comes into your town and you're planning on ushering him around in one of your pieces of fire apparatus personally, unless you have a command van unit, I'm not sure why you would need a 22-inch high raised roof cab with Vista windows, but a lot of people seem to favor those. Well, by the time you plop that on the top of your cab roof, and we throw the now in a rescue engine style body with a double high side compartments and a rectangular water tank. Now if you look at a side profile of the rig, the cab is now by far and away the highest point of the vehicle. The pump enclosure is kind of squashed down in the middle, and the body's up higher than that. So that's caused us now to take our deck gun, and now from just about every vendor, we can have an extender gun, which will raise the gun anywhere from 12 to 18 inches. You can manually, or now there's automatic versions, pop that up to get that up to be the high point of the rig. And now you can maybe get 360-degree rotation. Well, then take that one step further. Now we can get that instead of a manual gun. It's available from a bunch of different of the brass manufacturers to get remote control guns, which are great because that saves having to put a brother or sister firefighter up on top of the pump. But if you look at the cost of those devices in particular and how frequently, or more importantly, how infrequently they may be used, and an alternative might be, instead of investing in that remote control top mount device gun, to maybe look at doing two things at a lesser cost. One would be to carry a portable, in some locales they're called a step board gun, tail board gun, the terminology that I picked up back in the 1980s from the Central Pennsylvania was they called it a bomb line, which today, given today's Homeland Security issues, if you said you had a bomb line on your fire truck, people may, and next thing you know, you may be having this somebody from the CIA knocking at your fire station doorstep. But a portable master stream device pre-connected to somewhere between 150 to, depending upon your jurisdiction, 250 feet of lightweight 3-inch hose that gives you the ability to have a large caliber stream pre-connected and easily deployed off the rig by one person without ever having to climb up to the top of the rig and position it wherever you need it on the fire ground, not just where your pump operator or chauffeur decided to stop. That in conjunction with either a top-mounted gun or another non-pre-connected portable gun that's kept in a compartment that would allow you to deploy it a secondary large caliber stream even further away or at another remote point from the vehicle, gives you the ability to operate, again, safely on the fire ground, put the streams where you want them, without having to have this combination of, we've kind of forced ourselves now from a technology standpoint that, and from a water delivery standpoint, because of everything else we've done on the fire ground, done with our fire truck, we've taken a normal, call it $1,500 large caliber stream device, and while they're very good and they're safe because it causes the pump operators to stay down on the ground, we've now taken the cost of that and brought it up to the $7,000 to $8,000 range, and then in some cases, which pains us even more greatly, you take that device and then you put a combination fog nozzle on it and make it even less effective rather than putting a stream shaper and some smoothbore tips on there. So there's a couple of things to look at. In most cases, if you have an overweight unit, you want to find out about that pretty rapidly. If you don't have the proper access steps or non-slip surfaces to access the top of your rig, you can retrofit those. A couple hundred dollars later with some lights and the proper stepping arrangements, you can make your existing rigs much safer for the brother and sister firefighters to operate on. And if you have a top mount deck gun that's got an extended gun device, well, you're probably not going to want to go take it off for the sake of removing it from the rig. But the next time you're out specifying a new piece of apparatus, be thinking about the combination of how all of these things interrelate. And to appease some members on the committee that want to be able to stand up in a cab and have a high body at the rear and then sump the pump box down to the point where you can't operate your master stream device, those kinds of things don't seem to make a whole lot of sense, but you see a lot of folks do it.
Just to speak to the raised roof issue, a couple of other concerns. If you're buying particularly a mid-mounted tower, the raised roof actually becomes counterproductive. It cuts down on your scrub area and your usability of the piece that you spend $800,000 or $900,000 for. With the raised roof, why would you want to buy one? And most jurisdictions buy them so that firefighters can stand up and get dressed. Again, going back to those firefighters that were recently criminally charged in apparatus accidents, the one in particular in California where the operator was charged for failure to make sure that his crew was seated and belted. So now we're not just talking about a lawsuit, but we're actually talking about jail time by not following the NFPA standard, which states that all firefighters must be in a seated, belted, and closed position before the operator can engage the vehicle in any gear at all. And so in this particular case with a raised roof, if you are going to allow firefighters to stand up and get dressed on the way to the call, you could actually be looking at certainly civil, if not criminal, action if a wreck were to occur.
All right. Next up, we want to talk about for just a couple minutes about the tag-on orders. In certain states in the United States, it is a very common practice that if one municipality, regardless of their size, buys a piece of apparatus, and this goes to other governmental purchases as well, but specifically to fire trucks, purchases a piece of apparatus, it allows any municipality within that jurisdiction to tag on to that order and get a vehicle that is similar, if not identical, depending upon the manufacturer's wishes to make to allow the other community to make changes, without then the other community having to go through the public bidding process. Depending upon how your municipality, township, fire department, or fire district operates, if you're in a situation like that, it may allow you to get a vehicle at a very attractive price, particularly if the municipality you're tagging onto or buying multiple units allows you to get the benefit of that tailboard purchase with the manufacturer. And again, depending upon how flexible the individual manufacturer's company might be, there's generally a fair amount of variance or flexibility allowed for the community tagging on to make some changes through a change order process that we'll be talking about in a few minutes to get the vehicle configured a little bit more closely to what the community may want to do. Now, sometimes the downside of that would be if your department is not real familiar or in tune with how the larger department or the department you're going to tag on to operates their equipment, you may be tagging on to that department's rig just to be able to say, hey, I have a rig just like the folks down the road in Department B, and then find out that Department B's operating procedures and so forth, or the way they staff their apparatus, is dramatically different from yours, and now that you've got a twin-looking item sitting in your apparatus bays, that maybe was not the best thing to go do. The big advantages of it typically are it shortens the cycle time from the time you initiate an order until you're going to get the unit if your department happens to be needing something rapidly, because much of the engineering for the product has already been done. Another advantage is what we had alluded to is from a financial perspective. If the department you're tagging onto has been a large user of vehicles and typically buy 5, 6, 8, 10 units a year, they're getting a very attractive price from the builder, and you're getting the ability to tag on to that lower price, even though your community might only be buying one of these vehicles. And it does give you the access to be able to leverage off the expertise of the department. If they've spent a lot of time researching certain individual components, particularly chassis-related items, this procedure is pretty common out in Southern California, where some of the larger departments like Los Angeles City and Los Angeles County, both of which I'm familiar with, have engaged long-term contracts with reputable manufacturers to supply engines and trucks to those departments. The manufacturers have allowed other communities in that jurisdiction to tag on to the LA City or the LA County order, make some changes, and be able to leverage off the fact that both of those departments have researched thoroughly what works for them, more importantly, what doesn't work, and a lot of the smaller issues that maybe a department wouldn't initially consider, like regarding filter accessibility or interchangeability of parts, or a lot of the things that be looked at from a mechanical or preventative maintenance aspect, you'd have the ability to leverage off that department's experience. And even a very small department operating a modest fleet would be able to get a piece of apparatus that would do a very, very fine job for them. Right, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes, and we'll be talking about what you can expect to happen after you sign that all-important contract and you're now awaiting the delivery of your new truck.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Hi, we're back with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand at the Apparatus Architect, and we'd like to encourage any of our listeners that may have questions on any apparatus-related topic, either something technical-related question to the apparatus itself or something procedural about the purchasing process or how to work or interface with salespeople, dealers, or manufacturers. We'd encourage you to send those questions in to the Apparatus Architect at firehouse.com, and we'll be happy to respond to those. A number of questions that we've got in the past where people had different queries, we've been very happy to take those and answer them over the air. And while we don't have the ability to respond to every one of those back personally, There have been ones that have come in that were of a critical nature where the department was looking for some advice to help them out of a jam or a safety-related issue. Mike and Tom, we do the very best we can to get back to you as promptly as possible. But if anyone, listeners, do have questions, once again, the address is the apparatus architect at firehouse.com, and we'll be happy to answer those in a future podcast. We're going to finish up today talking about the process of what happens after you sign that contract or your community sends out the purchase order to your chosen manufacturer, and what's going to happen behind the scenes while you're waiting for your new fire truck to show up at your doorstep and the ramp of your station. Typically, builders will cite, a manufacturer will give you a contractual time that they may be legally obligated to have the unit completed within a certain time frame, and that's typically quoted in calendar days. It was old school for people to use working days, but in a lot of cases that just got folks kind of confused, as saying, okay, well, there's 5 working days a week, but, you know, everybody doesn't work 52 weeks a year because you've got at least a couple weeks of vacation and plant shutdown. So the industry has pretty much over the last several years standardized on quoting delivery in calendar days after the receipt of the contract. And pretty standard is, depending upon the type of product, the complexity, and whether it's a straightforward pumper or, you know, it can be a very complex, hazmat or technical rescue unit, it can range anywhere from probably from like a low of 240, 250 days. So it's not uncommon to a lot of manufacturers to bid 300 to 365 calendar days after receipt of contract. Now, that doesn't mean that the day after you sign a contract, people are starting to bend and break metal and start working on your fire truck, but there are some things happening behind the scenes that you need to be made aware of. Most importantly, the next major event that happens after the contract goes in is that there will be a pre-construction conference. That can either be held at the site of the manufacturer, which is generally the recommended location. It may mean that your committee is going to have to devote some time and resources to be able to travel out to the manufacturer site, but that gives you access to the actual plant where the unit's going to be constructed, gives you access to sales and technical engineering staff folks that can help through questions if there's things that come up during the process. And typically that session, which is an all-day event on a multiple purchase where you've got a couple of units being built, it could be a day for each rig or several days, but typically everything can be done during one working day, and you basically go through the entire specification from front to rear and go through every detail of what's on the unit. This becomes extremely important, particularly in the area of if it's an engine, pump panel layout, and how instrumentation is going to be located there. On any type of rig, the layout and configuration of the compartments and where trays, shelves, tool boards, and so forth are going to be located and integrate with your equipment packaging that you have decided. It's also generally the last opportunity for you as a purchaser, whether it's a small committee or a large committee, to suggest or make any substantive changes on the vehicle and still get them incorporated into the final design. For example, not uncommon if the unit was bid off a specification you used on a previous equipment, piece of apparatus, and maybe was bid with an all strobe lighting package. Well, over the course of the last several years, technology with LED warning lights has advanced dramatically. So maybe you may have made the decision that, well, you've got a little extra money to spend and you'd like to entertain the thought of putting all LED warning lights, or maybe just changing all of the lighting on the vehicle, including some of the running lights and the compartment lights, to LED technology as well. The pre-construction conference is the opportunity for you to raise those things and to nail down what's going to be acceptable to the department and to specifically define how much it's going to cost to make those types of changes. After the pre-construction conference, the manufacturer then typically will detail and document all of the discussions, all of the changes, whether it was a deletion off the item, an additional item, or a clarification. That will come back in a written form And many times can come back in a written form that we can be transmitted electronically back to the department for their signatures and approvals on each of those individual items. Once those things are approved via the change order process, then the manufacturer's engineering group is off and running to, do the bills of materials and do all of the component ordering to allow them to actually manufacture the unit. The building process for the apparatus itself, depending upon the size of the manufacturer you've chosen, they can maybe build the complete rig front to rear in sometimes as little as 6 to 7 weeks. In other cases, the cycle time may be approaching several months. But understand that up to and including the pre-construction conference, the department still has a fair amount of control over what is going to be on the vehicle. After that process is concluded and the change orders are written and accepted, generally that closes that window of opportunity, and the department has to understand that then the manufacturer is off and running on actually ordering materials, designing the body, ordering major components, and while inspections during the in-process inspection at a mid-inspection or final inspection allows the department to verify that the unit is being built in compliance with the specifications, changes that you want to make at that stage can typically either become extremely costly to the point of not being doable by the community, or in some cases impossible. Adding things like additional shelves or trays inside compartments generally can be handled by the manufacturer or sometimes the selling dealership, but if you're going out for a mid-inspection, that's generally not the time to decide that the compartment behind the rear axle really needed to be 3 inches wider because you just bought a new PPV fan and now it's not going to fit. At that point, you're too late in the game.
But at the pre-construction conference, you can make changes without incurring any additional costs on the unit. Is that correct?
That's going to depend largely on how the manufacturer operates, Mike. With some manufacturers, the rules of engagement will be changes made up to and including the pre-construction would be done at the same price as it would have been had it been included in the original spec. And in other cases, very candidly, since building fire apparatus is a business that most people ostensibly want to make money at, they're not going to give the thing away, and in some cases there may be some additional cost because of when you're making that change. So one of the things you want to be aware of, if you're wearing the purchaser's hat, at that pre-construction conference, you want to know the rules of engagement right up front, and anything where you suspect there's going to be a cost involved, you want to find out what that cost is going to be and get that identified right away. Because the downside would be, as you as the purchaser want to go in there knowing, if you signed a contract, for example, for $372,000 for a piece of apparatus, you want to know or verbalize at that meeting if any changes, if because of the way your municipality is set up, you can make changes on the vehicle, but you do not have the ability to change the contract price, then you certainly want to make the manufacturer aware of that. At that point, if you want to make substantive changes, go back to the LED scenario that we said, and they'd say, okay, well, Chief Wilbur, we can put all LED warning lights on your fire truck, but it's going to cost an additional $4,300 to do that. And you say, well, I don't have any money to spend. Well, pretty obvious then you're not going to be able to make that change on the vehicle. On the other hand, if you do have a source of funding or a revenue stream that will allow you to make dollar and cent changes on the vehicle, not necessarily that you're going to tell the manufacturer that, but you're going to want to identify who in the committee or whom in the committee is empowered to make and sign those decisions and those changes on behalf of the department or on behalf of the community.
It's better to make the changes then right up front at the pre-construction conference. So better to do all the work on the front end than have a lot of pain and anguish on the back end of this.
Yeah, that pretty much makes sense. But here, we'll switch up hats for a second, all right? Now I'm going to put on a manufacturer's hat. My experience in the apparatus industry has been this process works very well because it's a two-way street. It's give and take, It's making sure that the manufacturer is going to build exactly what the customer wants, even if the customer, being the fire department, has changed their mind. More importantly, to identify that person in authority who can sign the change orders and is empowered to change the contract price up and down. I can tell you from personal experience, there's been a couple of occasions, and they haven't been very pleasurable, where the person who identified themselves as the committee chairman, be it a line firefighter, an officer in this one jurisdiction, it was the chief of the company, made some changes through the change order process that the manufacturer had in place that was all up front, above the board, and legal, and changed the contract price of the vehicle by about a little over $7,000. When the vehicle went to get delivered to this municipality, because it was a borough, the borough administrator said, "Well, thank you very much, Mr. Manufacturer, for your fire truck, and we appreciate your invoice. However, the chief of that fire company was not empowered to change the dollar and cent figure for the fire truck on behalf of the borough. He wasn't empowered to change things financially, so the $7,200 worth of changes that were legitimately put on the vehicle, the manufacturer was never able to get compensated for that, because as far as the borough was concerned, that station fire chief was not empowered to change the financial cost of the piece of apparatus. So from the manufacturer's perspective, need to be careful that the person who may be the most vocal, or the person who says, yes, we're going to make this change, there does need to be a little bit of sincere communication to make sure that that person is actually empowered, that he can change the dollar value of the vehicle so that there's no surprises when the vehicle does show up and the invoice is presented. It's the end of the play, and as you push back from the table and the waiter presents the check to you, you can say, yes, we have this money, and there's no surprise there. So the most important thing is to make sure that good communication is established up front, and that there are standardized or expectations for time fences as to when different things are going to happen. And if windows of opportunity are going to close on behalf of the fire department for when they can make changes, you want to be able to know that, when that is happening, and to make sure that both the manufacturer through the sales representative and your selling dealership and the department, that there's very, very good communication up front, knowing what the expectations of each party is. So
you mentioned time there. Some departments rush to put penalty clauses in delivery contracts based on the manufacturer perhaps taking additional time over and above the allotment of time or the quoted time at the time of contract and pre-construction. How do you feel about that?
Well, penalty clauses can work a couple of different ways. In a lot of cases where a community has a penalty clause embedded into their specs, in some cases it was a result of a really bad experience that they had at some point. And when they say an elephant never forgets, the fire service is right behind the elephant here, that it could have been something that happened back in the 60s, and that got into the spec for the next truck that they bought and has been there forever. Now, it can work a couple of different ways. If a manufacturer is going to accept a penalty clause, they very candidly are going to probably pad the contract by at least a couple of days. And if, for example, if their manufacturing process allows them to build a fire truck in 300 days, and they're going to accept a penalty clause of $100 per day, per calendar day, that you're late, instead of bidding $300, you know, a reasonable person would say, well, I'm going to throw a couple days on this just to cover myself for some contingencies that might come up, and they'll bid 320 or 330 days and then accept the penalty clause. Penalty clauses are more and more becoming commonplace because people, fire departments just view that, or municipal government views that as a commodity and just says, well, we can buy a dump truck, a police car, or whatever, and we can get that in X number of days, and if the guy doesn't deliver, it's our way to kind of recoup some of the monies. But understand that if, for example, at the pre-construction conference that we were just talking about, and this has happened to me personally, the people went in and bought a reasonably standard conventional pumper. Something has happened between the contract signing and the pre-construction conference in some cases, they could have, A, run into more money. Occasionally, they've decided, well, the rig's not going to get assigned to this station. It's getting assigned to another station, and we need to change up. In a couple of cases, it's happened that the leadership in the department changed from the time when the inception of the committee, and now there's a new fire chief or a new chief of operations or a new chief of support services in town, and this guy doesn't like what the other guy was going to buy, and at the pre-construction conference, the industry term is the truck blows up. Doesn't literally blow up, but the whole configuration of the vehicle changes substantially, that now you have an innumerable number of change orders that have to get written, deciphered, and approved. If those things happen, it is logical to expect that the manufacturer may say, okay, we originally bid, for example, 300 calendar days, but because you've made all of these changes, we're going to need to extend the delivery or need an additional 30 or 35 or 40 days to be able to engineer all of these changes and to get the vehicle on the line and to get it moving. Or the changes you've made have added substantially to the man hours that it's going to take from a production standpoint to build the unit. You might have to expect some pushback and have an extension of the delivery time. So understand, penalty clause in some departments is just viewed as a way for them to kind of have a hard line with the manufacturer. If you want to have a long-term relationship with this builder, if you have a decent-sized fleet, it's never going to be all one way. It can't all be on the fire department side. It obviously can't always fall over to the benefit of the manufacturer. So it needs to be a good two-way street of communication, and that if there is going to be a problem, or, for example, on larger rigs, very common on rescue trucks, where there's going to be extensive tool mounting involved. Well, the vehicle itself can get built within the contract period, but now you're going to ask the manufacturer or the manufacturer's service group or the sales force, your salesman, to mount, hand mount all of your tools within the compartments. It's not uncommon. That can take several hundred hours. So somebody says, okay, we had 200 hours to do tool mounting. Well, if you put two people on that job, that's still almost, you know, better than 2 weeks doing that. The department has to understand that that may be in addition to the original contracted time to build the apparatus as it was specified. So maybe in the future, if people have individual questions or have had good or bad circumstances surrounding an apparatus purchase with was embedded into penalty clauses, Mike and I would like to hear from you folks. We do get a lot of phone calls from folks who are frustrated because during the building process, after the contract, communication has broken down with the manufacturer for a number of reasons, and the fire department feels like they're kind of the most common heard comment is, we feel like we're being left out in the cold. We're not being talked to. They're kind of hiding something from us. And those are the kinds of fears that get embedded in with us, that the next time we buy something, we say, okay, we're going to put a penalty clause in there, figuring that will literally put the fear of God in the manufacturer, and it'll have to talk to us. But if something goes south during the post-contract process, in a lot of cases, it can distill down to it's just bad communication or the lack of communication back between the fire department or who the person within the department who's responsible for making that principal contact with the apparatus builder. So again, Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand, like to thank you folks for listening in to this edition of The Apparatus Architect. And for those folks that have questions or comments on the show, please send them in to theapparatusarchitect@firehouse.com. Thanks very much, and wish all the brother and sister firefighters out there very happy holidays, and stay safe.
Bye for now.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.